Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. My website is rusjournal.org, rusjournal.org. And I ask you to support financially my work and to keep me on the air and doing research here full time. Today, I want to talk about my favorite father of the church. He's my favorite church father for one important reason, and that is that he was a Platonist. And he remained a Platonist throughout his life as an Orthodox man. I came across, when I was 17 years old, Plato's, the very first philosophical work I ever read was Plato's Gorgias. A version of a paper I've written on that is on my website. And quickly after that, the Republic. I was just a kid. I was in no place to make any real decisions on things. But since I grew up in a secular home, nominally Christian home, my father was an atheist. My mother was a kind of a Sunday Christian, really not much of anything. The field was wide open. And I was a Platonist first. I love Plato, really due initially to the Gorgias, one of the greatest philosophical works ever written. And it is an attack, believe it or not, as strange as this might seem, it's an attack on modernity, despite the fact of being written 2,500 years ago. Nothing can be more relevant. To become a Christian after being a Platonist is very, very easy. St. Justin was the first man to make the argument that Plato was sort of a prophet to the Gentiles, a prophet to the Greeks. And he does make the argument in many places, mostly in his address to the Greeks, an article with an uncertain date, that Moses and many of the great Greek writers were in contact. Moses is mentioned in the Ptolemaic Hellenes, work of Appian. He mentions the Jews revolt against Amasis in Egypt, and Moses fled. You have great writers in the ancient world, like Alexander Polyhistor, Thallus, a historian, Castor, many, many others who are often rather obscure, but all spoke of the centerpiece of Moses' legislation and how central it is to the Greek idea. And this was not foreign. I mean, Greece and the Middle East are not very far apart. And there was a constant interchange between the two. Now, Justin Martyr died in 165 AD. This makes him highly problematic for the regime. He cites the Gospels and the work of the apostles and the canons as early as, 130, 140, without any, as if these are old authorities. It is a confrontation. It's absolute, and no one denies this, since Justin Martyr writes about his particular situation and who was ruling what, etc. And the other problem, of course, for the regime is that his great work is his debate with the Jew Trypho. Allegedly, Rabbi Tarfon, a Hellenized Jew. And so many of the debate, this is a huge, intellectually huge and lengthy polemic between the two. And you know, when you read this, very few people who bother to read it, nothing has changed. Justin Martyr and many like him were writing very competently, philosophically, very early on, which is, you know, very easy, almost lazy, proof that the church was already functioning with its hierarchy and canons and sacraments by 130, easily. St. Justin makes many references to the Delphic Oracle. The Oracle said that Moses worships God himself, but the priests of the Chaldeans worship the natural order. So many people like Alexander Polyhistor and even Herodotus scoured the libraries from the Middle East, Greece, North Africa, and discovered so many references to the Old Law in the Old Testament and its connection with very early Greek thinking. Sybil, for example, there is one God. The same goes for Homer, the same goes for Sophocles. The connection with the I Am, as Orpheus states. Ptolemy of Alexandria and his library, which was taken from every major city in the Near East and North Africa. And so much of this has been lost. And yet, Justin Martyr is making reference to it, and no one seems to notice. He says that Plato knew the prophets, intellectually or some other way, and this is where so many of his ideas of, you know, God and the judgment comes from. Homer's description of paradise is very similar to that of Eden. You know, Plato's connection with the fiery substance, with fire doesn't actually mean fire, it's an archetype of being, of power, of dynamism, the uncreated. That the pattern for the tabernacle in the Old Testament, this is the beginning of metaphysics, the source for our speculation about form and matter. Moses and Homer are very, very similar in terms of the pattern of man's creation. This is not an accident. St. Justin Martyr says that the stories of Jupiter, Zeus on his chariot, was taken from the prophet Elijah. The Meno, when Plato's Meno makes reference to grace, that virtue requires the divine energy in order to function. And ultimately, that truth requires purification. That the possession of truth is, in fact, a purification in and of itself. It's a process. It's a dialectic, more than anything else. Justin Martyr sometimes is referred to as Justin the Philosopher. His dates usually, they vary only by a year or two, 103 to 165. But he makes very, very clear the connection between Platonism and Orthodoxy. And he makes reference to the forms that have manifested themselves on earth in the form of a man. Human nature and the good have been reconciled in Christ's body, which is the church, which is vivified by the Spirit. In general terms, he changed the world. That Plato gave a rational justification for the Spirit, that unity has to come before multiplicity. Plato's, you know, very vague outline of the forms. This is as far as unaided human reason can go, but it was accurate as far as it can go. Justin, being a Stoic at one point, being a so-called pagan Platonist, he was aware of these schools, and so much of what they said was true, but only when these ideas and forms were incarnated was it actually available, whether as an object of philosophy or of personal connection. He referred to himself as a Christian Platonist. That Christ and the prophets were made recognizable to those in the Greek-speaking world, which was the dominant world at the time, through the Platonic system. His mission was to reconcile Plato with Christ, that Christ solved all the outstanding problems in Platonic and then later Stoic approaches to the world. The Old Testament prophets prepared Israel to receive its essence, its Redeemer, so Plato prepared the Greeks for Christ's presence intellectually. And of course, the shocking parallel between Socrates and Christ are too close and too clear to be dismissed. They were both slandered, falsely arrested, convicted on phony charges. Both men accepted their execution without protest. And Socrates, though obviously incompletely, was a prophet to the Greeks in a similar matter to Elijah, Samuel, or Jeremiah. But this is what St. Justin writes in his first apology. And the Sibyl, so that there should be a dissolution by God of things corruptible. The philosophers called the Stoics teach that even God himself shall be resolved into fire. And they say that the world is to be formed anew by this revolution. But we understand that God, the creator of all things, is superior to the things that are changed, or changeable. If therefore, on some point, we teach the same things as poets and philosophers whom you honor, and on some other points are fuller and more divine in our teaching, and if we alone afford proof of what we assert, why then are we unjustly hated more than all the others? For while we say that all things have been produced and arranged into a world by God, we seem to utter the same doctrine as Plato. While we say that there will be a burning up of all things, we shall seem to utter the same doctrine as the Stoics. And while we affirm that the souls of the wicked, being endowed with sensation even after death, are punished, that those of the good being delivered from punishment spent a blessed existence, we shall seem to say the same things as the poets and philosophers. While we maintain that men ought not to worship the works of their hands, we say the very things which have been said by the comic poet Meander, and other similar writers, for they have declared that the workman is greater than the work. Justin Martyr, as I've already told you, is a great catalog of so many of the great writers, both minor and major in the Greek world, who made reference either intellectually or directly to Moses, the old law, and the prophets. It's no coincidence, in other words, that Plato and the Stoics laid out their doctrines before Christ, since these doctrines, understood in a certain way, then made sense out of Christ's incarnation. The created order exists, the outlines of God can be dimly seen. Now, freshmen in college are often given the false dichotomy of Athens versus Jerusalem. It's a stupid dichotomy, like most things in academia, and it doesn't make much sense, because it generally believes that Athens was this rational, scholarly, scientific view of the world, while Jerusalem was an existential, faith-based one. Like a lot of these simplistic dualisms, it's completely false in every way. Justin makes very clear that this is a purely rational and scientific faith. Faith is a matter of coherence, not of some blind belief. In the same way, Plato can be seen to have tremendous mystical elements to him. So that Athens, Jerusalem is utter nonsense. And it's just, the unprepared academic mind. The problem here is that when you have writers in academia talking about someone like Justin, you have historians who are secular, who know very little about the history of philosophy or theology. Then you have philosophers who know very little about history or theology. You have good, even our theologians, who aren't good philosophers or historians. Then you have literary critics who aren't theologians, philosophers, or historians. All of these people working in a fragmented way, and all, with the exception of our theologians, of course, in a completely secular and anti-Christian environment. And so you'll have excellent historians have no idea really what Plato talked about, and they'll write these very banal kind of slogans about it, as if a historian can avoid being a philosopher. It's absolutely ridiculous that a historian can talk about Plato's impact on the world and not be deeply involved in Platonism. But that's how academia works. Justin Martyr is somebody that they would rather avoid. I read a work recently that his rhetorical address to the Greeks wasn't written by him. And well, it's in most of the collections of his works up until fairly recently. And I read the work, you know, unlike most people, I actually read more than the abstract. And it was a very poor analysis. They said that Justin Martyr believes in Greek thought, as if there's such a thing as Greek thought. But in this address, he says that he's very critical of Greek thought. And this is the argument. As if to say that the real Justin was a pure Platonist, and anyone who criticizes Plato, therefore, can't be the real Justin. That's the essence of the argument. It's a very bad one. I'm a Christian Platonist. I criticize Plato all the time. Christ always comes before Plato. Plato can only go so far. And then you have literary critics trying to talk about his writing style without having any idea about the historical or philosophical elements that at work. You add to that the fact that they are under great pressure to debunk some of this stuff, and it's not surprising you get very poor work. The person dealing with this has to be equally adept in philosophy, theology, and history. I'm one of the few who claim this, meaning that I had to work a lot harder than a lot of my fellow students years ago. For example, many Orthodox theologians refer to scholasticism. 99% of these people couldn't define the term, and I've never read a scholastic. There's a lot of scholastics in the East. But they use a word as sort of this negative, almost a curse word, that it must be bad. And yet scholasticism was all over the 19th century Russian catechisms and seminaries. But because they're steeped in the mind of the East, they're often unable or unwilling to get as equally steeped in the mind of the West. So you have these fragmented approaches to the problem, meaning that it takes a handful of people that have to then be steeped in all of it and all together, which of course is what, you know, a normal scholar would do. In today's academia, it has more to do with satisfying the structure of a department and its particular biases rather than a fully rounded understanding of things. Anyway, Plato's final destiny in Justin is to pave the European road to Christ. Christ and Christianity initially began as a Greek movement. You have people, no matter how many times I repeat this, Christ was born and raised in a Greek environment. Nazareth was, a Hebraic, mostly Hebraic town, but it was a tiny little suburb of Sepphoris, which is where Mary was from. If he was a carpenter, then he would have done most of his work in Sepphoris, where it was a Greek city. Galilee, the other word for Galilee was Decapolis. He was surrounded by Greek cities. And the earliest written work that we have is almost all Greek. And Justin also brings this out as well. Of course, the Old Testament prophets, the Mosaic Law, and Greek philosophy and literature knew each other. Of course they did. They lived in the same place. Justin is from Greek-speaking Syria. Actually, if you were to put it today, in today's geography, he was from the northern West Bank, which, of course, like everywhere else of any importance, was a Greek-speaking area. We're talking about a fairly small area where Greece meets Turkey and then the Middle East, the Greek language, the Roman Empire, and the tremendous system of roads and the sea created a system of constant communication. So you talk about the Old Testament as if it's sealed off from Greek thinking, and it most certainly is not. It couldn't be. But the incarnation, the single most philosophically significant event in global history, the form of the good, in which all of Plato's middle period forms were synthesized, had attached itself to the form of man, that is to say, human nature. this concept, even using Plato's terms, was the foundation of the faith. And it was done in, using these terms at the Council of Chalcedon in 431. Without the Platonic system, the doctrines of human nature, divine nature, etc., could not have been understood, and certainly couldn't be been understood as efficiently if they didn't understand Platonism and Stoicism. They use a language, but if they use a language, that means they use the concepts in the system itself. It created an intense vocabulary, a powerful vocabulary, to describe very complicated ideas. And Latin, unfortunately, struggled with that. And the philosopher, like Justin, is going to approach the faith differently than the theologian or the historian. The philosopher is going to seek the ontological consistency of the incarnation and use metaphysical language to describe it. The theological content or meaning of the incarnation, though, will be outside of the philosopher's thinking. Only formal quantities will be analyzed. Philosophy is the very form of the apologetic, since the words of revelation, the scriptures, won't have any meaning to the pagan. Those who don't recognize the incarnation won't be swayed by scriptural arguments, since scripture itself needs justification. So philosophy's role is to show how the incarnation is possible, and how it could be understood by the secular mind. Philosophy leads the mind to God. Plato said so. That determinist in God, philosophy has no role and no purpose. It becomes sophistry. The professional metaphysicians at the university writing for money and academic fame. Well, if the spirit is real, then it has to derive from a source capable of producing non-material reality. Now, in his very famous debate with Trifo the Jew, he says this. He's referring to himself here. Plato indeed says, replied I, that the mind's eye is of such nature and has been given for this end, that we may see that very being when the mind is pure itself, who is the cause of all discerned by the mind, having no color, no form, no greatness, nothing indeed, which the bodily eye looks upon. But it's something of this sort, Plato goes on to say, that is beyond all essence, unutterable, inexplicable, but alone honorable and good, coming suddenly to the souls well dispositioned on account of their affinity to and desire of seeing him. Trifo the Jew responds, what affinity then is there between us and God? Is the soul also divine and immortal, and a part of the very regal mind? And even as that sees God, so also is it attainable by us to conceive the deity in our mind, and thence to be happy? And Justin says yes. This is the ontology of life. This is the ascent. St. Augustine would say the same. Mind's ascent, and something like, you know, the nominalist scientific mind today knows of no ascent. It could never even conceive of an ascent, or a descent for that matter. The very conception here is a refutation of the nominalist and modern mind. For the forms of nominalism, the mind is merely a mechanism that can combine and analyze sense experience and create universals, quote-unquote, that make sense out of them for further study, just as convenient terms. Logos is a doctrine that was first systematized by Justin. Logos is the world soul of Plotinus. The world soul was a much lower manifestation of God. In a sense, the collection of Aristotle's instantiated essences is the world soul. The essences of all things, created things, taken together, is the world soul. For Justin and many other fathers, the soul was one. It was Logos, or Christ himself, seen under the point of view of the sciences. The Logos doctrine has argued that natural laws have to have a source. The fact that this needs to be argued is a bit of an issue, but that source has to, by necessity, contain all laws. It has to be the law of law. It's God, Christ, Logos. It's present in nature as a guarantee of its normal and regular functioning. The fall of Adam, though, invaded the natural world and rendered Logos less clear. In fact, obscured it altogether for most people. Christ's presence is only barely seen by most people. The unredeemed human being can only see cause and effect, and absolutely nothing else. And certainly not the purpose and origin of it. St. Justin says, I'll give you another testimony. God begat before all creatures a beginning, certain rational power proceeding from himself, who was called by the Holy Spirit, now the glory of the Lord, now the Son, again wisdom, an angel, God, Lord, and Logos. On another occasion, he calls himself the ruler, when he appeared in human form to Joshua, the son of Nun, the captain, the general. He could be called by all these names, since he ministers to the Father's will, he was begotten of the Father by an act of will, just as we see happening amongst ourselves. When we give out some word, we beget that, begot that word, not, you know, as to lessen the word, as it remains in us. When we give it out, and just as we see it also happening in the case of something else, for example, a fire, which is not lessened when it has kindled another, but remains the same. And that which has been kindled by it likewise appears to exist of itself, not diminishing from that which was kindled. The word of wisdom, which is himself the God, begotten of the Father of all things. The word wisdom and power, glory of the begetter, will bear evidence. When he speaks by Solomon, he says this, if I declare to you what happens daily, I shall call to mind events from everlasting. The Lord made me in the beginning of his ways, of his works. From everlasting he established me in the beginning, before he had made the earth, and before he had made the depth, the spring of the waters that stood forth, before the mountains had been established, before all the hills, before everything, he begets me. I know that sounds convoluted to most people. The thing that he has begotten is Logos. Reason is the reason in the modern world refers to utilitarian logic, the ability to get what you're supposed to want, and that no more than that. The truth that civilization is based on that concept of reason, you know, what the ancients understood nature as not being dead, waiting for the industrial titans for the new Atlantis to give it meaning. Reason resides in us. Reason resides in everything. Anomalous can't be a Christian. It doesn't make sense. God is Trinity, is the end of all things. Men work to imitate the life of Christ and to experience the grace or presence of Christ in the resurrection. Justin refers to Logos, for example, as being in different races of men. He says it certainly exists in all of them, although not to the same degree, and it is not manifest the same way. The obscuring of Logos, or the law of law, I am, the foundation, Spinoza's substance, whatever. After the fall, Justin makes it clear that the evil angels fell through fornication with female humans, that they had enough of a, that they had become perverted enough that they actually had some form of physical bearing. And through that, they created the Titans, or the giants. That these Titans, we still use that phrase today, the Titans of industry, they created civilization. Now, when I say civilization, we're talking about bureaucracy. We're talking about power, classes, hierarchy, in the bad sense of the term, money, rents, usury, constant warfare, imperialism, expansion, self-justification, that kind of thing. Culture is another matter, of course. But he also makes reference, and I've kind of hit on this very briefly, that the term immortal mean that it's unbegotten. He says the soul is subject to decay. It's part of the world. It's created. The soul is corruptible, therefore it's created. God alone is immortal, and therefore souls could die unless they're given immortality by God himself. Around the time where St. Justin is debating with Trifo the Jew, some of the major criticisms against the church in that early date was, the first of all, that it's being promoted by men of no reputation. And the other major one was that it's new. They never made the argument that somehow this mirrors, you know, so-called pagan doctrines. Most of that actually is the other way around. In fact, Justin, being familiar with them far greater than we could be, says that after the cross, the alteration of the civic deities and mysteries changed to reflect that. The key thing that St. Justin accuses the Jews of in his debate with Trypho is that after the resurrection, prior to the destruction of the temple, they created squads of men and sent them out to begin spreading rumors, to begin introducing new doctrines. He says that all of the pagan uprisings against Christianity, or I should say persecutions of Christianity, were at the behest of Jews. As they've done in so many other places, they'd go to the prefect and say, the Christians don't want to pay taxes, they're fomenting rebellion, whatever it is. And these could be, you know, zealots themselves, and will say that the Christians, this is what they're doing, and they're refusing to pay taxes and everything else. But in my edition of the works of St. Justin, there are several documents that are fascinating and they're not discussed very often. The first is the Epistle of the Emperor Titus to the Assembly in Asia. It's undated, but the Emperor Titus, of course, is well known. And he says that Christians are really an example to the empire. He doesn't see them as a threat by any means. And he says that we are the ones that don't really have the confidence in the old gods. And really that the church is persecuted because of this inability to deal with the collapse of the old system, intellectually speaking. That they are gaining adherence primarily because they are completely contemptuous of death. And of course, the other is the epistle of Marcus Aurelius to the Senate. And he tells a story that when he was on campaign in Germany, he prayed to the, you know, whatever kind of request he made in his desperation, as he was surrounded and outnumbered as always. And for whatever reason, he says, you know, things are getting worse. Being a philosopher and being in desperate straits, he prayed to Christ. And he said, the atheists, as of course they were referred to at the time, have gone with them. He prayed for water at a time where his men were dying of thirst, in a severe drought, and he received it. And he said, Christianity will not be illegal in this, at least while I'm around. There'll be no prosecution unless you could prove to me that they're dangerous. Now, those two documents are included in my edition of St. Justin's works. But the broader point is that, as Justin says over and over again, that those who have the logos, everyone from Plato to Socrates to himself, will be hated and attacked. And that's chapter 8 of the Second Apology. That the poets, the propagandists, the sophists, Plato is right to throw out of his ideal city. These are the last people who should be talking about theology. This is a matter of reason. This is a matter of science, not a matter of what we would call today blind faith. And he says to Trypho, he says, you Jews are responsible for creating story after story and rumor after rumor, and that you have actual squads of men that you are creating and training to go out, meaning that we are a tremendous threat to you. And he actually says, this is chapter 17. Chapter 17, that they use the media of the day, and they spread lies this way. Whether different schools, different institutions, you know, as close to a mass media as they had at the time. Justin makes it very clear that they're using it against the church. And he says that the old law was created precisely because of the evil of the Jews. It served a purpose. And, you know, Justin does say something, you know, very extremely controversial, that really the gifts, you know, the Jews, well, we would say today, of course, have been completely cut off, and that the Jews in every respect have been cut away. So the Christian identity idea of this same group of people, you know, eventually wandering into Europe, is denied. And in a racial sense, and in every sense, this group of people has been completely cut off. And that, the so-called replacement theory, and that those same promises in the Old Testament have been transferred to the New. So Justin, so far, is making a few statements. Number one, that Plato is absolutely essential to the faith. Number two, that the Old Testament and the Greek writers were extremely close and constantly back and forth. Number three, as I've said many times, that the faith is Greek. And even in the Old Testament, Greek was a very important medium. Number four, that most of the Greek tradition pointed to God. Most of it believed in one God that rules all, one natural law, one truth, manifest in different peoples in different ways. Not the concept of one God, that is to say, one lawgiver, is to be found in almost every major ancient Greek writer. Aeschylus, he mentions Sophocles, Philemon. But natural law is to be followed by all. I mean, he's Trifo tries to trip him up, and he says, you know, what happens about people who don't know the faith? You know, never come across it. He says natural law can be followed by everybody. Natural law is to be found in the conscience. And from that source, people can be saved who have your so-called invincible ignorance. And then finally, he accuses Trifo of this intense hatred. It doesn't make any sense to him except in terms of political hatred and political threats. The Jewish hatred of Christians becomes the very nature of Judaism. But most importantly, the concept of the Logos is essential to everything that St. Justin does. Logos is the reason of God, so to speak. It's the thought and the expression of the Father. The words of God were communicated solely by the Holy Spirit at Christ's baptism. The Spirit was, in fact, the very approval of the Father of the Son. The Father's communication with the world is both the Son and the Spirit, and the world determines the church on earth. Logos is the image of the Father. He's individual by his personality, but never by substance. Like in Spinoza, God is a single, fathomless substance that is infinity and hence not accessible to thought. But the substance thinks. Now, both Spinoza and Plotinus reject that idea. Not because it's an impossibility to them, but the personality of God is outside of the canon of philosophy or geometry. His personhood, the existential concept, that is the domain of theology. Logos is the intermediary between the Father and the universe, the sole domain of theology. Logos is a principle of the universe, but also the principle of revelation. Logos is the Father's reason and thought manifest in created things. To assume that Logos doesn't exist forces you to say this. But natural law pre-exists matter, which would actually prove that Logos exists. Or that natural law somehow evolved with matter, meaning that evolution needed to evolve, which doesn't make any sense. But that also requires someone to hold a dogma. But there was a time where the laws of nature didn't exist. I'm not sure how anything could have developed. See, Aristotle's idea was to claim that all matter is eternal. That's also the dogma of the Masonic lodges. since dead matter is the Ein Sof, the so-called God of the Kabbalah, the primordial chaos, the reality that's chosen, the new men, in Nietzsche sense, have a right to manipulate with pleasure. The Ein Sof is God in the higher degrees. There is no Jewish theology. There is no pagan theology in the sense of the mysteries, the initiatory sciences, the Gnostic so-called sacraments are for the uninitiated. But the fact of the matter is, when you have the Ein Sof or the flux as so-called God, this is what you require for something like the Industrial Revolution. It's a direct descendant of this thinking. You're saying that God and so-called creation isn't really anything. It's a chaotic flux. But even today, you can't say that, because the modern scientific establishment says that matter is essentially encased energy, and it's winding down. Therefore, it can't be eternal. But Logos is never separated from his point of origin. He's generated from the Father. He was generated before time began, and hence outside of time. Logos is then eternal, but not matter. And this is how you could beget and still be eternal and be coexisting from the beginning. Because we say the word beginning, we're assuming time, but there was no time at the time. Salvation, in more practical terms, is a way of life, a way of will within the grace of the Spirit, but that's available only in the church. Salvation, in Platonic terms, is a life according to reason. Now, in St. Justin, it's a life according to Logos, which is a specific reason of the Father. So salvation is based on righteousness and is almost identical to it. Salvation is a state of affairs, while righteousness is a summation of the virtues. It's a lifestyle. The arts of civilization, as I mentioned before, these were taught by these fallen angels to the so-called Titans. The, you know, first civilizations were oligarchies. This is a demonic political system. For us, of course, it's the Orthodox national monarchy. For demons, it's oligarchy and republics. Demons are, you know, for the most part, although not entirely, highly intelligent, always trying to imitate God. They sought to create something through the creation of civilization. They can't create out of nothing. The notion ex nihilo was a bizarre thing for the ancients because the concept of zero didn't exist. And so out of nothing didn't make any sense. And it's one of the proofs that it was an actual revelation from God, because there was no conception of zero at the time. But demons were always trying to imitate God. They can't create out of nothing, so what do? Civilization is their imitation of God's creation. So they have to use pre-existing matter to create their will on earth. And that's the nature of the great states like Assyria. You know, even Atlantis, or the idea of Atlantis, or modern, you know, edifice like New York. We say civilization, again, this is a bureaucratic, centralized structure. And it culminates in the iconic Temple of Solomon. And remember, Temple of Solomon, the apostate, that first temple, based on forced labor and centralized control, the final image, the final gnosis of the demonic arts and sciences. Now, all the Christian civilizations have a god of the arts, Apollo, Prometheus, Set, Osiris, Ahura Mazda, and many others. You can found in all the few remaining fragments of what might be the seminal text of these cults. They're myths in the sense, in the real sense. They represent true things, but they're poeticized. All civilizations that have ever existed have had this god of science. But the specific science dealing with building and controlling, though, it's not just science in the sense of knowledge. It's science in the sense of domination. It's a constant desire to create a machine out of that which isn't a machine, or the organic. That typifies these deities. They're not actual deities. They're conceptions. They're archetypes. Now, St. Justin does say that they are poetic images and sort of memories of these titans these demons copulating with women, either literally or figuratively or intellectually. That taught man, someone like Cain, who was explicitly taught to do this, to create civilization in the sense that we're talking about here. The Old Testament shows Cain as being taught by these beings. Now, Cain can't be expected to build a city from nothing, but he was taught. That city that he built becomes the heart of Mesopotamian civilization. And the heart of that is the oligarchic ruling class, a materialist, you know, pseudo-metaphysics and forced labor. The freed life of the spirit is out of the question. These deities are not creators, they're architects. But there's always this tendency, when you read the ancient stories, to impose our Christian ideas onto this theology, even refer to it as theology. Creator gods don't exist. They are architects at best, who create out of primal chaos without there being any creator of the matter that makes up the primal chaos. Because primal chaos has to be something. And I've said this many times, but these entities, the copulation with human women to create the giants or the titans, these are the demons that brought fire from heaven, so to speak, that teach man to create civilization. The fire is just that, to be self-sufficient without God. Remember, Solomon died an apostate and heretic. He did not repent, and he was begged to repent. The Temple of Solomon, the apostate, is the iconic idea in modern occult thinking. Technology was the magic of the ancient world. The civilizations of Egypt or Assyria were very advanced in the practical sciences. Now, modern historians really have nothing to say when you ask them where this knowledge came from, because our first recorded history is of functioning large centralized civilizations. But the civilization, at its essence, creates the goyim, human beings as chattel, masses. Civilization in the Babylonian or even modern industrial sense, these are the practical manifestations of the temple. Technology is demonic because its purpose is to raise the ruling class, who benefits from it, to the status of near godhood. And then human sacrifice, of course, is a ritualistic manifestation of the same idea. When God creates out of nothing, he creates organic entities. If you ever studied the ridiculous levels of complexity of DNA, RNA, proteins, amino acids, and everything else, it's an entire immensely complex civilization in pieces of the genome, let alone the cell itself. And the genome, you know, gives the instructions are granted to it and a chemical language. At the same time, you have it in social life, these extremely complex entities that show up out of nowhere. Of course, DNA, RNA can't be subject to evolution. It doesn't make sense. If you've ever read about the complexity of the translation systems, the data retrieval systems that these structures have, you know, you'll be your head will spin. Obviously, these, you know, billions of pieces of datum organized perfectly with almost zero margin of error, of course, you know, evolution survived DNA, the discovery of DNA, and remember, you know, Darwin just thought that the cell was this piece of jelly. This is what God creates. So demons are always trying to imitate this. So what do they create? They create the machine. And Prometheus is the same as the ancient god archetype as Lucifer and Set. They're gods of rebellion, but rebellion in a specific sense of taking practical techniques from the domain of heaven, quote-unquote, and giving it to mankind or the ruling elite, who then uses that to enslave others. And human sacrifice is a manifestation of this. It plays out the massive human slaughter that exists as a direct cause of technology. Not merely slaughter and the wars, but millennia of slavery, serfdom, bondage, you know, going back to the very beginning of history, which is the beginning of bondage. It's a practical technics. It's meant as a demonic substitute for the organic world. While fallen, it contains all that's necessary for human survival. Only those who lusted for power sought to harness the substitute nature to artificially enhance their power over others in the guise of so-called enlightenment. This artificiality is, it's unnatural, it's against nature, and it requires, therefore, sacrifice. Christ came to bind these demons. The church is a practical regulation of the needs of human beings. When Christ said, you know, don't worry about what you eat, what you drink, this is what the Gentiles worry about. This is a direct condemnation of the ancient occult magical arts that are called technology today. This is the absolute center of St. Justin and his own social philosophy and his own views of the ancient church and the tradition. Brotherhoods of the faithful were created as a natural extension of the organic extended family. And this is where your Jewish hatred of those institutions developed. They were at the forefront of all anti-Christian persecutions and retain all the ancient magical arts that artificially increase their power over others. And in the dialogue with Trypho, he makes this very clear. You know, ritual was real, but simple in the ancient church. It's based around all the ancient texts. Members of the church strove for purity because you couldn't understand anything without purity. The church was based on the soul, but locally organized. Societies are informed by the spirit. Bishops in apostolic succession were important, but they served to inform the local groups of true doctrine. They were never dictators by any means, but they were just stewards of the gospel. But if you have to summarize the nature of St. Justin's thinking, and it is fragmentary, because his the surviving writings are there's completed works, but there are not many of them, centered around the notion that we can't separate scriptural texts from the tradition of the Greek world. To put the Semitic and the Greek at odds, that it makes sense, but to think that you could separate the development of the church, even in the Old Testament times, from Greek thinking is absolutely impossible. And, you know, I was educated to think that these are two totally different worlds that hold ridiculous Athens versus Jerusalem, two separate universes that have nothing in common, which is ridiculous. And it's a form of propaganda. It's to say that reason has nothing to do with whether it be ritual or revelation. And yet, St. Justin is explaining, and so many of these works have been lost today, that the great libraries of the Near East, Ptolemaic, Hellenic libraries, contained the constant references to Moses and the Old Law as one of the greatest and most original of the ancient legislators. I gave the list of these guys, Hellenicus, Philochorus, Castor Thallus, Alexander Polyhistor, Appian of Egypt, on and on, who made reference to the one God of Moses, the great legislator. And you deal with the ancient myths and stories, which is really what it's like St. Augustine, St. Justin spent a lot of time worrying about. This is something where you have to actually read the fragments that exist. When you read the interpretations in the secondary sources, you realize that there's a deliberate fraud going on. That, you know, they disguise references to monotheism. They disguise so many of the things that we would recognize today. And and one of the big things is that the constant striving for the singular God that they don't quite know yet. But Plato was able to call the form of the good. Now, he spends a lot of time, Justin spends a lot of time talking about the fire of the Stoics. When you think of the earth, air, fire, water, square of the ancients, remember, these are archetypes. These aren't actual physical things. These are essentially Platonic forms. Fire is, I mean, you have even in our prayers for communion, you are fire by nature. Now, they're not referring to the fire that burns in a fireplace. Fire is the energy. It's the divinity, but not a divinity that simply sits like this inert substance, but a divinity that is working, creating, and intervening on our behalf. It is the I am. The I am concept you find everywhere, even in ancient references to Moses himself. The I am, which is what Yahweh means, is the being of being. You can't prove it because any proof assumes it. You can't talk about logic unless you first assume that nature is regular. Now, we talked about Hegel last time. The struggle was to find this presuppositionless scientific beginning that Descartes failed to do. These issues were quite alive. I mean, the cogito comes from St. Augustine. I am, and you hear it from Sybil, even Plato comes very close to it. You know, God has no name, as Plato states. That means that the being of being can't be described. No name means, okay, his name's not Phil or Joe. That's not what the word name, that's what the word name, you know, didn't mean that. Name, the name of something is what we might call the definition of something. That we have this deep understanding of not just the thing itself, but its relations with everything else. And to constantly deepen this, and you realize that, like we said last week, with Hegel, that even a tiny little thing like a wallet is of almost infinite depth. When you refer to I am or Yahweh, you're referring to that very regularity that makes any kind of logical design possible. You can't prove the existence of it because you're asking to prove the nature of a proof. One of the central concepts in St. Justin's philosophy of history is the Titans. We've mentioned before, Logos, the natural law, the organic world, is confronted on a regular basis by these Titans. Titans, of course, are half demonic, whether in an actual genetic sense or in a more figurative sense, however you want to read the myth of Prometheus. That this is the demonic influence over humanity. He states it in very practical terms, that the titans of industry, oligarchy, is precisely what the demons had created, which then created the very first early civilizations of Mesopotamia. This is the nature of what we would call demonic influence. So you have, you know, a very deep theological conception, but then when you understand it from the rest of his thinking, you realize it's actually very social and it's very practical. Demons actually attempted to become a hypostasis. And of course, they failed. So they had this kind of monstrous abortion-style existence of demons copulating with women and creating monsters. The titans, we refer to them all the time, the great elites, the evil elites throughout history, and the dark oligarchy today, men who don't seem to ever have to take responsibility for what they do. They have immense power. This is the nature of demonic deceit. This is what we mean. We refer to leading people astray through the fantasies that these titans create. And of course, today with television and media, it's like no other time. But the use of the media by the Jews, who are the forebearers of this oligarchy, or as already mentioned here in roughly the year 130 when the dialogue with Trypho first occurred. In Plato's Timaeus, Plato is referring to Logos, and therefore the Son of God, Logos, one and the same, as being placed crosswise in the universe. And Justin makes the case, unfortunately some of his documents don't exist anymore, that this was directly taken, and this was first a figure of the cross, and it was directly taken from the ability of Moses when he held up the, you know, cross-like, you know, bronze snake on a stick, that not only protected people from being infected, but of course destroyed the infestation of poisonous snakes. And so in the Timaeus, where Plato refers to Logos, appearing on earth in a cross or a crosswise position, and it seems sort of odd, even, you know, if you're reading it at the time, he claims that this had come from nowhere, that the entire metaphysical tradition of Plato and Aristotle is from the Old Testament, comes from the intensely complex symbolism of the temple and of the tabernacle. Anyway, it's hard to give a presentation on St. Justin because it's fragmentary. The extant works are fairly brief, except for the dialogue with the Jew. But all of these conceptions of oligarchy, of organic versus non-organic, but most importantly, the connection of Platonic doctrine from Plato himself, not the Neoplatonists, a different matter, from Plato himself to the Old Testament. And he creates these parallels between the two that are very impressive. St. Justin is the greatest and earliest father of the church, remains one of the dominant fathers of the church, unfortunately. Many of his extant writings are very few, but they're certainly worth your time, and he writes for a mass audience. Christianity initially was a Greek religion with strong Platonic foundation. And so much of that Platonic foundation even comes in some indirect sense from the old law. And that's the thesis of St. Justin. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.